This webcast is a service of South Dakota Public Broadcasting. More information at sd.net.
Center Preparations will now come to order. Again, we want to welcome the internet listeners. We have three bills and one Senate concurrent resolution that we're going to take up. Actually, Senate Bill 150, the prime sponsor has asked that just be deferred because he's pitching a bill in another committee, so we're not going to take that one up today. But with that, Madam Secretary, if you'd please call the roll.
Sutton.
Here.
Nessaba. Cronin. Partridge.
Yep.
Peters.
Here.
Haverly.
Here.
White.
Here.
Wick.
Here.
Tiedemann.
Here.
We have a quorum.
We do have a quorum. So with that, I'd ask that our two pages come forward and introduce themselves, come to an open mic. We want to thank you for your service during this week, 2 weeks that you've been here. And share where you're from, your name, where you're from, and where you plan to go to school afterwards.
My name is Ross Euler. I'm from Rapid City Central, and I plan on going to USD for political science and international studies.
Go
yo! It's a wily animal.
Yes. Hi, I'm Shelby Guthrie. I'm from Pierre TF Riggs, and I plan to go to South Dakota School of Mines and Technology for chemical engineering.
Good.
Oh.
Good luck as you go forward. Okay, with that, we'll take up Senate Bill 111 to revise the administrative rule regarding income eligibility for assistance with child care costs. Senate Bill 111, proponents of Senate Bill 111. You can take it from right there, Senator Sutton.
Appreciate it, Mr. Chair. Billy Sutton, District 21, Senator. I think I'll first preface my remarks with the knowledge that I understand we have some difficult budget times ahead, but that I do think this is an incredibly important issue to have a discussion about and something that I feel very, very strongly that needs to be addressed. Imagine an hourly employee being offered a raise and saying, no thanks, not now. Some working parents face that tough decision too often. The problem is that even a modest raise can push a family's income over the top limit to qualify for publicly funded child care assistance. Currently, the level of that someone is qualifies is at 175% of federal poverty or lower, or about $4,148 per month for a family of five. There's a sliding scale of support below 175% of federal poverty. So the lower you go on the scale, the more support you get. So this is also calculated on gross income, meaning that there are no deductions available. This was changed during the cut years of 2011 when it used to be 200% of federal poverty. And so this bill would simply strike the 175 and go back to 200%. And if you're at 175% of federal poverty, that's about $441 in state support. You can apply for renewal every 6 months, and I believe that there's also a federal update coming. They may have implemented that already that allows you to only have to request renewal every 12 months with a two-month grace period starting, I think, maybe this last October. The situation that was brought to me is that a constituent got disqualified losing their support due to a commission that their the spouse had received of $200. The wife was only making $1,900 per month, and daycare costs for three kids were $1,538 per month. With travel, work, and gas expenses, this individual was essentially either forced to continue going to work and losing money, or quit that individual's job and stay home and take care of the kids. And that is exactly what happened. The individual quit their job and decided to stay home with the three kids because they were going to lose money by working. And that is a really frustrating situation. Right now, there are 230,700 people below 200% of federal poverty in South Dakota. 15% of South Dakotans under 200% of federal poverty have concerns about child care issues that affect their employment based on South Dakota Kids Count numbers. The cost of this bill would be $938,724 is the estimate that I got from Department of Social Services, and it would cover an additional 137 families. Frustration I have here is that there's essentially an incentive not to work if you make too much money or if your income varies at the wrong time and increases average pay at the wrong time. If you get a small raise, it could put you over the qualifications limit. There are no deductions for gross income, and there's just a large amount of volatility that can be created from overtime hours or commissions received. We should be encouraging people to work, not discouraging them. And it's my belief that we have a moral obligation to support working families that are just doing the best they can to get by. So with that, I will stand by for any questions. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Sutton. Other proponents of Senate Bill 111? Other proponents of Senate Bill 111? Any other proponents of Senate Bill 111? We'll now open it up to opponent testimony. Opponents to Senate Bill 111.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Mark Quasney with the Bureau of Finance and Management. I'm going to ask you to vote no today on Senate Bill 111. As Senator Sutton said, this bill would cost $938,724 in its first year to implement. We spent 2 hours this morning going over what can only be described as soft revenue estimates going forward. And substantial cuts would be required to the budget to enact these subsidy enhancements. So with that, I'll stand by for any questions. Thanks.
Thank you. Any other opponents to Senate Bill 111? Any other opponents to Senate Bill 111? Seeing none, I'll give you a chance for a rebuttal, Senator Sutton.
I would respectfully state that it's the legislature's budget. It's our job to pass the budget. We get to decide what gets cut or what gets passed. And that's our job, not the second floor's at this point. It's in our hands. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Okay, we'll now open it up to committee questions. Any questions? Yes, Senator Peters.
Thank you. I have a question. So during the Department of Social Services, when they did their budget part of this hearing for child care costs, they had talked about changing some of the rules so it wasn't such a dramatic decrease. So if somebody did get, let's say, a nickel raise or a dime raise or a quarter raise, that it wouldn't be just an all or nothing situation. Have you looked at what those proposed rules might be?
Thank you, Ms. Chair. I have not seen what those rules are. My understanding was is they had changed the time frame and created a grace period, but I'm not aware of those other rule changes.
Do you have an answer, second floor, Mr. Quasney?
Mr. Chair, Senator, so the specific changes you're referencing is we no longer we once somebody is deemed eligible for these benefits, they have a mandatory 12 months before any income reevaluation is made. And also, upon that reevaluation, if they're deemed over the 175%, they're given a 2-month grace period where they're not kicked off of the subsidies to allow them to put a plan in place to get child care. So, thank you.
Yes, go ahead, Senator
Thank you.
Peters.
So following up, the way I was understanding the changes in this program, there were they were going to change the sliding scale so it wasn't such a dramatic off. So let's say I understand we're at 175 and the senator wants to take it to 200, which I completely understand why he's trying to go back to where we were. It's actually a good idea in some respects. But in the hearing of Department of Social Services, they talked about changing the sliding scale so it wasn't such a dramatic drop-off. So they're not going to change the different eligibility based on income with under 175. So you make a little bit more money. It's based on a sliding scale, as we understand it. So if, as you make more money, even if you're under the 175 mark, as you make more money, your benefit goes down. And my understanding was is they were going to make that so there were more slots, so it wasn't such a huge drop in service or a huge drop in subsidy. Does that make sense?
Go ahead, Senator Sutton, and we'll go to Mr. Quasi. So go ahead.
I can provide that information for you. I have the fiscal year 2017 monthly co-payments. I don't know if they're proposing to change that, but already it is a sliding scale that for every percentage increase in the federal poverty rate, it's about $2 to $3 difference in payment. So as you get much lower on the scale, you get a better payment. Your co-payment goes down, is what I should say.
Mr. Chair, the impetus for this is federal rule changes that went in place in 2015. And so rather than a sliding scale, which was one of the options available to us, the federal rule allowed us to create this two-month grace period. So it doesn't matter in that 2 months what your income is. You are still eligible for the subsidy.
Yes, go ahead.
Thank you. Well, I appreciate that. That was not my understanding of when they pitched their budget. So it's interesting that they chose to do the two-month grace period instead of changing the sliding scale to be more reflective. So just because you get a dime raise, it shouldn't kick you out a $100 benefit. Does that make sense? So now they're going to just do the two-month grace period to come up with a plan instead of the sliding scale changes to make it so it's less dramatic of a change as you make more money?
My understanding of the sliding scale is that it would still be just a continuation of the sliding scale, but your benefit would still end. So it's not going to just extend it indefinitely based on your income. Your benefit would still have to come to an end at some point. So we're over the 175.
Yes, Senator Haverly, questions?
Well, Mr. Chair, thank you. Sort of to Senator Peters, what is happening in the real world is somebody gets a dollar an hour raise, so they're getting $40 more a week. They're getting kicked off of child care, and now they have to pay the $140 or $160, whatever it happens to be in that area. So the grace period doesn't help. It's that little bit of pay raise that's what's hurting people.
Thank you for sharing that. Other questions from the committee? Yes, Senator Nessebar.
Mr. Chair, and just to speculate a little bit, I think to actually fix that chart would also have budget repercussions, and we probably would actually require a bill to change that. At the moment, when I looked at that chart, there really was a 100% tax, effectively, that if you made an extra $100 per month, you lost $100 worth of subsidy. So it was a highly punishing disincentive to work. So I would stand in favor of this legislation. I understand that the budget is tight, but I think we do have a responsibility to care for those that are least among us, and particularly those that are working hard and trying to make progress. So I hope we can find somewhere else in the budget to cut to accommodate this.
Now, I respect your comments. We're still in the question, so I didn't find a question that, but I do understand what you're saying. Any other questions? The one I have, the $938,000, that's general funds and would be matched with other funds, correct?
Yeah, thank you. I should have clarified that. That is correct, and that was a number that I asked DSS to provide as an estimate. So it is an estimate, just to be clear, and that is just general fund.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Peters.
Thank you. I haven't looked back at the hearing, but how much has been reverted out of this program every year?
Mr. Chair, I don't know the answer to that. I do not.
When we get to discussion, okay? Any other questions? Then we'll go into discussion and or action. Senator Haverly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To begin, first I can answer Senator Peters. In 2017, they're reverting $1.4 million. So for the last couple years that I've been on appropriations, I have been curious about the amount of the excess child care. And as I stated earlier, in the real world, I still see people suffering to pay and to pay for quality care. There has to be a cutoff. I get it. And I also understand revenues were very bleak. The three issues that are here are the minimum wage went up Therefore, costs to child care centers went up. They're charging more because they had to pay more on wages, food, et cetera. Remember, now this is the key too, and it'll come into play later because a vast majority simply do not charge by the hour, which is how you get reimbursed. You contract for spots there, so you still have to pay. Now, like I said, number two, you get a pay raise, you get kicked off assistance or get a different rate of reimbursement. You know, hooray, that's what we want. That's what I keep hearing from social services each year. People are making more money, so therefore we're reverting some of the child care assistance. But again, like I said, $40 more a week can get you kicked off and you have to completely pay. So what's happening? People have to figure out a way to pay or take another position. They quit their job, and we all know what happens then. Now there's other assistance that comes into play. Or, and this is from the business and my economic development side, people are jumping daycares. They're leaving that extra amount that they're supposed to be paying, so they jump daycares until it gets caught up with them. What's truly happening? Parents are stressed. People are trying, and they're getting priced out, and they're quitting their jobs. Daycares are struggling. To me, though, the most important thing is the children are suffering because they're not getting the consistency that they need while we've got parents that are trying to pay. So I personally think the entire program probably needs a major overhaul. But today I will be supporting this, even with the revenue.
Okay. Other committee discussion? Senator Peters.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. While I completely respect Senator Haverly's position on this bill, and I admire Senator Sutton for bringing this, I think that we can, it's not going to help the upper income if we're going from the 175 to the 200. I do believe that we can make rule changes within the program without bringing a bill to take advantage of some of the reversions in that program to make it so it's less dramatic. In addition to some of the federal rule changes, it's not going to help the 175 to the 200, and I completely understand where we're coming from. I actually agree with this move as well. However, knowing that we are going to be making some very difficult decisions in the next month, this one does not, at this point, come to that level of where we need to be. And so I probably will not be supporting this bill at this time. But I do appreciate the comments made by the prime sponsor and Senator Haverly, because I do think it's something that when we have money, this is, should be one of the priorities that we look at.
Okay. Senator Wynn.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I move we send Senate Bill 111 to the 41st day.
Is there a second? Seconded by Senator Partridge. Any discussion on that motion?
I would just like to echo the comments of both Senator Peters and Senator Haverly. This would be a great thing to move up to if the money was there. But based on what we've heard today, it's really time to hunker down, and hopefully we can move within the rule change to make this work.
Any other comments on the motion? Senator Sutton.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate the discussion, and it seems like you know, everybody seems to understand the issue, and that you know, in different economic times, maybe this would be a more broad discussion. But with that being said, I will be bringing the bill again next year, and so if things are looking better, I expect to have you all behind me.
And comments from the chair. I agree with what you've brought forth, Senator Sutton, but again, because of the financial situation, I don't think we can support it. Personally, I think it's very important that the children have a consistent provider. Child care is an economic development issue. People, when they move into communities looking for a job, they're also looking for where their children can be cared for, because in our state, about 80% of the households, both are employed. But at this point in time, I can't support it. With that, Madam Secretary, please call the roll on Senate Bill 111 to go to the 41st day. Those in favor say aye. Those opposed, nay.
Sutton?
No.
Nessaba?
Nay.
Cronin is excused. Partridge?
Aye.
Peters?
Aye.
Haverly?
No.
White?
Aye.
Wick?
Aye.
Tiedemann?
Aye.
It's 5-3.
Senate Bill 111 will go to the 41st day. will now bring up Senate Bill 1113. Senate Bill 113 requires certain provisions to be met before distribution of the 911 emergency surcharge revenue and revise the effective date for the sunset clause provision that lower the 911 emergency surcharge and revise the method of distributing funds. Proponents of Senate Bill 113. No, you can sit right there.
I just wanted to make sure.
You need more room. No, that's perfect.
I'll kick out my representatives. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, Senator Peters.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I brought Senate Bill 113 after listening for the last 4 years in government operations and audit, talking to the 911 Coordination Board since they give a report to the Government Operations and Audit Committee. And within the report, and I have several years worth here, in the report it talks about bringing up that we gave them all of this authority for rulemaking and for compliance. However, we did not give them the ability for enforcement. So it doesn't make a lot of sense for us to give them rulemaking authority, but then not giving them anything to enforce the rules with. So Senate Bill 113 basically has two sections. One, the first section talks about some of the it just adds in language to the current statute. If the public safety answering point is not in compliance with the standards for operation and utilization of public safety answering points as determined by the board shall notify the public agency by receiving the revenue. And within 90 days, the public safety answering point serving the public agency does not become compliant with the standards for operation or utilization or submit a plan to the board to be approved by the board detailing how they will become into compliance, the Department of Public Safety may not remit revenue to the public agency. Basically, what we've got is after the last few years, we've got 7 counties out there now that are still out of compliance after we put in the rules. And we need a little bit of a stick to get them into compliance. We're in the final rolling out phases of the next-gen 911 system. And in doing that, I think that these counties should be doing the small things and the small steps in order to become in compliance. Sometimes it's just as simple as approving a certain policy or adopting a policy within the county. Nothing that they have to recreate. All the counties have similar policies. It's just the matter of adopting the policy. So it's just giving a little bit of a stick to the stick and carrot for the money. The second section talks, so when we put this next gen system in and we've put the surcharge, additional surcharge money on the 911 fund, what it does is it moves out the sunset clause by 1 year. It pushes it from July 1st of 2018 to July 1st, 2019. And the reason we did this, I initially was going to extend the surcharge and for another 5 years or whatnot, but it has come to our attention that we really need to come up with a more systematic way of looking at how we're going to fund, a more systematic, a more consistent funding methodology for not just 911, but maybe telecommunications. If you look at our state telecommunications tax structure, we're one of the highest taxed telecommunications industry, so we probably need to take a look at some of the arenas in that. Interesting, I had some interns do some looking at our 911 fee collection. If you notice, it's been stagnant. So because it's been stagnant, it's not going to grow. It's not a sustainable source for the technology that we have put in place. And so we're going to need to take a look at a long-term sustainability mechanism to fund our public safety and our 911 system. So that's why I've extended it 1 year. It gives us 2 years to work through this maze of telecommunications taxes. When we heard from the Department of Human Services, there's a report that we received in early January that talks about a couple of the other telecommunications taxes that are on our bills, the telecommunication relay services, and where the money, and that's actually declining because it's based on landlines. But with technology today, do we really need to have those types of fees and taxes, and maybe we just maneuver around? But that's going to be part of a work group over the next 2 years to come up with a long-term sustainable future for not just our 911 system, but just telecommunications taxes in general. So with that, I guess I'll stand by for further proponents and then stand by for questions. But that's the gist of Senate Bill 113, and I'd appreciate your support.
Thank you, Senator Peters. Other proponents for Senate Bill 113? Other proponents.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I am Shawnee Rechtenbaugh. I am the Deputy Secretary for the Department of Public Safety, and I'm also the State 911 Coordinator. I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 113, and I'll be very brief. First, I just wanted to thank Senator Peters for including us in the discussions as she prepared this bill. Simply stated, Senate Bill 113 will ensure that all 911 centers in South Dakota are providing the same level of emergency service. So no matter where someone is when they call 911, you can be sure consistent 911 service will be provided to all citizens and visitors to our great state. We would ask for your full support on Senate Bill 113, and I'll stand by for any questions.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Rechtenbaugh. Other proponents to Senate Bill 113? Other proponents to Senate Bill 113? Seeing none, are there any opponents to Senate Bill 113? Any opponents to Senate Bill 113? Seeing none, we'll close public testimony and open it up to committee questions.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator White.
Question for the sponsor. I see that there's a 70% number here of that they're looking to move, shall remit each month 70% of revenue collected. What is that percent right now?
Yep, go ahead.
Thank you. That is actually current state statute. The only thing that I'm adding is lines 11 through 14 on the first page. So that is current statute. The lines 7 through 10 are current. Almost all of 7 through 11 are current state statute. I'm not proposing any changes in that area at this time.
Follow-up?
Go ahead.
And then in line 12, it says, however, if the public safety answering point is not in compliance with standards of the operation and so forth, how many of these points are not in compliance?
Yes,
thank you for the question. It is 7 at this time.
I thought that's what I saw in your testimony. Follow?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, so as far as what we're attempting to do with this bill, then, is to clarify that they are being recognized as not being in compliance, and that in the event that they don't come into compliance, they're going to lose a portion of their 70%. Is that correct?
Yes, go ahead.
Thank you. It's not necessarily that they're out of compliance. All we're asking for them to do is to come up with a plan to get into compliance. At this time, there's 7 counties that are currently out of compliance. We don't necessarily want them to lose their funding, but they need to at least approach the board, the 911 coordination board, with a plan that's approved to become in compliance. It's not that they will lose their money right away. It could take a year, 18 months. But as long as they communicate with the 911 coordination board that they have a plan and the steps that you're taking to get there, they would not lose their money.
Follow?
Go ahead.
So there is a detailed plan or a number of months or something that gives them time to become in compliance. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair. Absolutely. Yes. Within 90 days, if the public safety answering point serving the public agency does not become compliant with the standards for operation or submit a plan to the board. So if they completely disregard the board's request to become in compliance or completely disregard coming up with a plan and communicating the plan with the board, if they completely disregard it, that's when they would lose their money. But as long as there's an open dialogue between the board and the county or the municipal league, then they shouldn't be losing their money.
One more time, possibly.
Yes, go ahead.
I just, this is, 9-11 is just a tremendous thing that we have out there, especially in rural America, that is tested with the personnel and the funding for it. And I think that if we are going to require any type of renovation of the process, that we give them proper time and notice so that this 9/11 service isn't jeopardized in any way. I just really feel that we have to make that clear up front. Thank you.
Other committee questions? Yes, Senator Nessaba.
Mr. Chair, I'm just unclear about what is the nature of the non-compliance. Can you just give an example of what it means to be non-compliant?
I'm going to let the 911 Coordination Board, Shawnee, Ms. Rechtenbach, answer that question. She's the one that does the reviews of each of the different 911 agencies, and so she would have the exact specifics. I have the general detail of who's not in compliance, but I don't know the numbers of reasons.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, go ahead.
As Senator Peters mentioned, it could be something as simple, so to speak, as a policy that they're missing. Some of the administrative rules require that they have a policy in place that in the event of an outage with their phone system, they have to have a backup plan. Where are they going to go? What are they going to do? And they need to have a policy that lays that out. They may already have the procedure in place, they just haven't put it in policy. So without the policy, that would be a noncompliance.
Good question. I was going to ask the same thing, so thank you for the answer, Ms. Rechtenbach. Other questions from the committee? Good. With that, we'll close questions and move into discussion and or action.
Mr. Chair.
Yes. Senator Wick.
I move due pass on Senate Bill 113.
Move due pass by Senator Wick, seconded by Senator Partridge. Discussion on the motion.
I think the case has been made pretty well, and there's no opposition testimony to balance it against. So I think slam dunk.
Senator White, do you have any questions on the slam dunk?
No, I don't. I just really want to reemphasize that if there's going to be some type of established rules that they have to meet, that they make the notice to these seven areas and give them time to do it. And I certainly wouldn't want it to be some frivolous thing that would discontinue the any type of revenue sources to that particular district. That's the only thing I have a concern about.
Senator Peters.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate the previous speaker's comments. It is important to note that these rules have been put in place for about 4 years. They change and update them, but they are communicated to the county, to the sheriffs, to the cities. Everyone that's all of the major role players within the community that has the 911 system have been communicated. They are fully aware. The counties and the cities have actually agreed to help us work through some of the counties that are having issues and to share best practices to ensure that we get these counties in compliance, and they're going to hopefully get most of these up and running and back on track with a plan, at least, without losing funds. I mean, the whole goal is the plan before losing funds. The rules have been in place for 4 years. It's just a matter of getting them up to speed.
Okay. Any other discussion on the motion, do pass? If not, the motion is to do pass on Senate Bill 113. Those in favor will say aye. Those opposed, nay. And the Secretary, please call the roll.
Sutton's excused. Nessebar?
Aye.
Cronin?
Aye.
Partridge?
Aye.
Peters?
Aye.
Haverly?
Aye.
White?
Aye.
Wick?
Aye.
Tiedemann?
Aye.
Eight.
Senate Bill 113, due pass, goes to the floor. Any title amendment, anything? No. Okay. We're fine. Good, because I had heard you talking, so that's why I was asking.
Mr. Chair, basically what the deal is because we're extending the sunset 1 year, it changes. So in statute, it would revert the old funding of the 911 fee. And so because we're extending it 1 year, it technically changes the fee distribution, even though it's not mentioned in the bill. So that's the question that I was asking. Fred obviously felt that we needed to keep the title in there. The lieutenant governor the presiding officer might have a different story on the floor. We'll find out.
Right. Okay, good. Thank you. Senate Bill 152, you want us to defer that, Senator Cronin? Okay, that's deferred. We need to have you go get Senator Stalzer.
Okay.
423. So we'll just be at ease while he is brought down here. So can we recess?
Yeah.
Because I don't know how long it's going to take him. So we'll just recess for a few minutes. We'll call Senate Appropriations back to order. Yeah, we have the lost has been found. Again, thank you very much for waiting on us. Next up on the agenda is Senate Concurrent Resolution 9 to accept an invitation to attend a Balanced Budget Amendment Planning Committee. Proponents to Senate Concurrent Resolution 9.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Senator Jim Stalzer from District 11 in Sioux Falls. And this is resolution is a little bit probably non-standard in that 2 years ago, Senator Otten and I brought a resolution to the body to call for a convention of states for a balanced budget. That was passed. It has been filed and is in the congressional record in both the U.S. House and the U.S. Senate. And at that time, we talked about bringing back rules for holding such a convention. And that bill was actually heard this morning in local government and has been delayed for a fiscal note. But in the process, I was appointed along with Representative Latterell and Senator Netherton, and Senator Lederman has been involved in that process as well, to work with a group called the Assembly of State Legislatures to propose rules under which a convention for proposing amendments might be held. And so that there is a companion bill that, again, is working its way through. But at the same time, Tennessee is planning to hold a convention this summer for purposes of planning and implementing the baseline set of rules if a convention is called. Currently, the Balanced Budget Amendment proposal has 28 states with 34 required to actually hold a convention. And so the purpose of the convention they would be asking us to join this summer would be to put a baseline in place, just like when we come into a legislative session, we adopt the previous rules as our temporary rules, and then we move forward. So the resolution could have been done in a couple of ways. It could have been just taken straight to the executive board. And I talked to leadership on both sides, the House and the Senate, and they seem to like the idea of bringing it to the full body to get the consensus of the House and Senate beyond just the executive board. So I brought it as a resolution as opposed to a bill because an invitation has not yet been extended, and therefore codifying it might require us to do something that might never happen. And while a resolution does not have the effect of the status of requiring it be done, it would be more a sense of the legislature that we should participate in this process. The penalty for not participating is not having our input. And what I handed out to you are some of the things that we would want in a set of rules from our delegation to ensure that states like South Dakota have a fair voice. And I'll just quickly run through some of them. First, it has to be authorized under Article 5 of the Constitution, which says 34 states apply for it, the U.S. Congress calls for it, sets a time and place. And the second would be that only states would be the participants in this process, which is what is called for under Article 5, that the scope of the convention would be under whatever is called for by two-thirds of the states, keeping in mind that ultimately to pass anything out of there takes ratification by three-fourths of the states. Okay. That the convention should allow us to discipline or recall or instruct our delegates so that South Dakota's process is in place. And that the rules don't infringe upon our rights as a sovereign state to control our delegation. That voting should be by the majority of the states attending the convention, and subcommittees and so on should be a majority of the membership. And that voting should be one state, one vote. This is probably the most dangerous thing if we were not to participate in the process, is that we could. There have been larger states who have wanted to impose electoral college type voting, in which case South Dakota would have practically no voice. And this process of conventions of states has always been done as sovereign states, with each state having its own equal vote. And then again, it says that there shall be no apportionment or whatever, and that a quorum shall consist of the majority of the states, and any product coming out should be from a majority of the states, or 26 plus states. So in discussing this with leadership and with LRC, the intention would be that this would be like our other travel, and that it would come out of the LRC travel budget and not have a special appropriation attached to it. Sending the way the law portion of it's coming through, we would send five delegates. And in the past, when we've attended these, and some of them I have attended at state expense, some of them I paid my own expenses, as have some of the other participants. And as the law is written, the legislature would appropriate as funds are available. It does not designate that it has to be out-of-state funds. So I would ask that you pass this on to the Senate, so that we can get a vote of the entire Senate to see if they approve us participating in such a process. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Stalzer. Other proponents to Senate Concurrent Resolution 9? Other proponents to Senate Concurrent Resolution 9? Are there any opponents to Senate Concurrent Resolution 9? Any opponents? Seeing none, we'll open it up for committee questions. Any questions? Yes, Senator Cronin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator, I think right at the end of your statement, you talked about, or during your statement, you talked about former Senator Lederman. It's a two-part question,
yes,
if I may, Mr. Chair. Who are the members of this group going, okay, first of all, and second of all, has the legislature ever paid for someone who's not in the legislature to go on travel other than staff?
Okay. First of all, the bill that would be coming through, the speaker would appoint two delegates, the president pro tem would appoint two delegates, and together they would appoint one. And so this would be left in the hands of leadership. In discussions with the president of the Senate, that it's possible that if someone outside the legislature, perhaps executive branch, then the governor's budget would cover that person. And again, that's an exec board decision when it really comes down to it. But that is the discussion I've had with the lieutenant governor.
Go ahead, Senator Cronin.
Okay. And just to clarify, who can they appoint? Who can the speaker and the senator, the president pro tem appoint? Is it all legislators, or can they appoint anyone they wish to appoint?
In the legislation, we have not defined that. If the legislature decides they want to amend that to put some specifics on it, I certainly wouldn't have a problem with that. And it does expire in 2 years, so it's only the current speaker and the current pro tem as far as appointing people. We would readdress it in 2 years.
And then just one follow-up. So in this concurrent resolution, does it state anywhere in there where the money comes from? Because I don't see e-board, okay, unless it's under a section.
It's under that section where it refers to, I have to, 12-15-whatever, and it's in the bill, and it says that we would pay for the delegation, public meetings, which there would not be on this particular one. This one would, that would be for a convention for proposing amendments. This is a planning convention for purposes of putting things in place. And in general, the discussions have been that it would go through the exec board and it would come out of the normal LRC travel budget. It would be, you know, basically equivalent to sending five people to an NCSL or an ALEC event as far as general cost.
Senator Stalzer,
yes, sir.
In this resolution, it doesn't say anything about expending money or approval. I think that's in Senate Bill 160.
That is in Senate Bill 160. Right. That is correct.
So this does not talk anything about it's the Senate concurrent resolution just talks about accepting
and specifying. And these items that I gave you are in 160.
Right.
And it refers to that.
So my question,
yes.
Since we passed it 2 years ago, does that still give us the invitation? Is this concurrent resolution needed to allow South Dakota delegates to go?
This is outside of the resolution from 2 years ago. 2 years ago's resolution is calling for a specific convention for amendments. This is a convention for planning and putting rules in place so the convention wouldn't spend the first 6 weeks discussing what the rules should be.
Any other committee questions? Yes, Senator Nesba.
Mr. Chair and Senator, I just have broader questions, if I could, about
sure.
about a balanced budget amendment. Could you just talk a little bit about how a balanced budget amendment would work, and in particular, what effect it would have had on the U.S. economy in 2008 and 2009 during our last recession? We had a briefing this morning, and I could see from economist Terwilliger that back in 2009 that U.S. unemployment increased from about 5% to 10% unemployment. And one of the things that happened was a stimulus package that was passed in 2009 that helped bring that rate down. Could you just explain to me how a balanced budget amendment would have affected that differently?
That's actually outside the scope of this particular resolution, but if the chair wishes, I can address it to some extent.
Well, I think go ahead to give a little background to some of our newer members.
Okay.
Very briefly, because we have another committee that's coming in.
Right. Generally, we think that at this point, if we were to impose a federal balanced budget, there is time to do it by slow, gradual reductions in spending. The balanced budget amendment could propose both restrictions on spending and restrictions on taxation to get the federal government within compliance, potentially would give an escape clause for a war or that type of situation. And those were all the things that were discussed when this was passed 2 years ago. It basically comes down to if, you know, we want a seat at the table, we need to participate. And again, we have been involved in a process with the Assembly of State Legislatures for the from July or June of 2013. We had our first meeting. We met in Mount Vernon that fall. We've met in Indianapolis at the state capitol. We've met at the Utah state capitol. And our final meeting was in Philadelphia this summer. Some of those I have been reimbursed, some I'm not. I was appointed by the Speaker of the House and the Majority Leader to represent the legislature at those, as were the other people that I mentioned.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Nesba.
I'll keep it short. Two follow-ups. One, how would our lives in this room be concretely better if we had a balanced budget amendment today?
I don't know that today particularly, but for someone my age who has grandchildren that I'm concerned about, I do not believe that we can continue the spending that we have been doing without seriously eroding our monetary system. We would the easiest way is to inflate our way out of it, in which case retired people like me would be left behind. And I think by addressing this at this time, we have the opportunity to do it in a manner that will not be devastating. But if our monetary system collapses, we're all going to be. Just look at the Soviet Union a few years back.
Just a follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Oh, go ahead.
What concrete indicators would you point to? When I look out at the world as an economist, and there's a reason I think that the vast majority of economists think that a balanced budget amendment is a dangerous idea, I see low interest rates and low inflation. And so I can understand why somebody might speculate or use a bad metaphor thinking that a federal government budget is like a household budget. I just think they're fundamentally different things. So what concrete data would you point to that the sky is falling?
Greece.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Go ahead, quick.
Greece doesn't have its own currency. It adopted the euro, which is a fundamental problem. The U.S. government is able to spend its own dollars. Its debts are denominated in its own currency. I think the threat of default is zero.
Okay. Again, we've moved into kind of the discussion phase. We've got to keep focusing on the questions. Any other questions?
I have one.
Go ahead, Senator Peters.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question that I have is, you had brought it up in your previous testimony, but I want to make sure I fully understand it. Currently, the e-board can approve this travel. Currently, the presiding officers can approve the travel. Why do we need a resolution to do that?
Basically, to get buy-in from the Senate and the House.
And the question I have, we'll get the same buy-in by passing Senate Bill 160. Correct?
Very likely.
Yeah. I mean, so. Okay. With that, we'll stop the questions and move into action and or discussion. Senator Peters?
Did you have something?
Yes, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I have a hard time with this bill because I do think that something needs to be done. I mean, whether I have the concrete evidence or not, we do have a problem. We keep spending more than we bring in, and we're faced with that in this very committee room later on this afternoon, or upstairs, but tomorrow, and this morning we talked about it. It's not as simple as a balancing a household checkbook, but in some aspects, I think it kind of is. You know, you've got to prioritize where you go. But what I'm afraid of in this one, it has no concrete details in it. And I would hate to see this pass and the bill fail, and then we turn around to this as a guiding principle, where it doesn't tell us where the money comes from. It doesn't tell us who's appointed to this committee. And therefore, I understand the premise of what you're bringing here, but I don't see the need to have the same discussion twice. And this one thing that I do not appreciate is if this was the only thing we had, that's one thing. But since we have a bill floating through, I don't appreciate getting told whether I'm good or bad, whether I'm Republican or Democrat, whether I'm a rhino or whatever. And every single time these type of things come up, we see this happen all over the country. And not just all over the country, but right here amongst our own members. So, you know, with that, I understand the senator's reasoning, but I think if the buy-in comes in, I think that comes in with who we elect to the e-board. And if our state is going to support an Article 5 convention, I believe that hopefully we'll get to see the bill. I believe that it should be legislators on that committee, beings that we're the ones that passed it, we're the ones that took ownership in it, and we're the ones that should be there discussing what we want to in this state. So with that, I would ask, I can't support this today in its current form, and I look forward to seeing the companion bill.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Peters.
Move to table.
Second. Moved by Senator Peters and seconded by Senator Partridge to table. That's a non-discussion motion. Secretary, please call the roll. Those in favor say aye. Those opposed, nay.
Sutton is excused. Nessebar?
Aye.
Cronin?
Aye.
Partridge?
Aye.
Peters?
Aye.
Haverly?
Aye.
White?
Aye.
Wick?
No.
Tiedemann?
Aye.
7-1.
Senate Concurrent Resolution 9 has been tabled. With that, anything else to come before? Seeing none, I'll entertain a motion to adjourn.
Move to adjourn.
Moved by Senator Wick, seconded by Senator Peters to adjourn. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. We are adjourned.